I want to welcome all of you here this afternoon who've come out to hear Carolyn Forché, and thank you for finding a parking place. And I see you must have because you're here and not circling like the rings of Saturn. But anyway, we're glad you're with us. I want to mention at the beginning that all of the events in the Michigan Writer Series are recorded, and the audio is streamed from both the library catalog and the MWS homepage. So you can hear again what you're hearing this afternoon. I'll also say that Carolyn was on WKAR this morning on Current State, and if you didn't catch her, she was on about 9:35, so probably this evening about 6:35 she'll be on again. So
25.
What?
9:25.
Yeah. Yes. Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. So listen at 6:25 or go to the website and click on the link. Carolyn gave a wonderful reading for us last night over in the RCAH, and we're delighted to have her for 2 days. I can't believe she's still standing up and talking because she's been talking since she arrived. But anyway, this is her... Well, I was going to say this is her last event for the day, but it's not. There are two more. So she's a trooper, let me tell you. So without further ado, Carolyn Forché's poem, The Colonel, written about one of her many experiences in El Salvador and appearing in her book, The Country Between Us, must be one of the most widely read and quoted poems in contemporary American literature. I have used that poem in workshops with high school students, One Book, One Community workshops, workshops with writers in the high desert of New Mexico, and I've read it over again and again to myself to remind me of the power of language, of voice, and of witness. El Salvador is not the only troubled place Carolyn Forché has visited and written about. And in those travels, she has become aware of and a proponent for the writers whose daily lives are entwined with the events we, in America, call news or feature stories or the terrible events of our times. In the early 1900s, Forché edited an anthology featuring some of those writers, Against Forgetting, 20th Century Poetry of Witness, poems which speak out in defiance of regimes of oppression and the atrocities they commit, but which also, sometimes on a very personal level, hold out the seeds of hope and change for a new time. Carolyn is with us at Michigan State today to talk about her travels, her writing, her call for us to bear witness. The final poem in The Country Between Us, Ourselves or Nothing, concludes with these lines. There is a cyclone fence between ourselves and the slaughter, and behind it we hover in a calm, protected world like netted fish, exactly like netted fish. It is either the beginning or the end of the world, and the choice is ourselves or nothing. Please welcome Carolyn Forché.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm really thrilled to be here. I worked in this building, in the library, when I was an undergraduate. So this is a little bit of coming home, actually in the Labor and Industrial Relations Library, which I've heard, nothing I've ever done exists any longer. Everything has been, because I also graduated from Justin Morrill. So everything's been, but Michigan State is Michigan State, and I'm really happy to be here. I feel like I'm at home. I want to share with you a few remarks that I wrote about poetry and poetry of witness and as it bears upon my own experience. And then I'd like to devote most of this to question and answers that you have so we can have a dialogue. For many years, I've been reading and collecting the works of poets who endured conditions of extremity and wrote in its aftermath. This effort began after my return from El Salvador on March 16, 1980, in the time of the death squads, and it was before the war began in earnest. After that, I also traveled and worked in Beirut, Lebanon, there for National Public Radio, and South Africa in the late years of apartheid. We didn't at the time know that these were the late years. We didn't know apartheid was going to end when it did. And certain of these experiences, in mosaic chips of images, remembered speech and incident began to appear in my poems. At first, I didn't recognize the dangers inherent in failing to repress such material, that it was regarded by some as inappropriate for poetry. That is to say, the poetry written in my country in that period. That it would be regarded as political, a vaguely defined term almost always pejoratively deployed. Political poetry, admitting of contemporary and often controversial events, was considered inevitably to fail as poetry, insofar as it subsumed lyric art beneath a programmatic mission of persuasion. Well, that's my sort of synopsis of the arguments that I've heard against it. But if one is genuinely writing something rather than attempting to write about something, as Beckett famously said of Joyce, then it seems to me that poets have little conscious choice in the matter. Their art emerges on paper before it is known to themselves. It begins in a not knowing rather than in a moral impulse. Words and language are not wrappings in which things are packed for the commerce of those who write and speak, wrote Martin Heidegger. It is in words and language that things first come into being and are. A poet's consciousness is, in this sense, improvisational and open to transformations, felicitous accidents, and an intuitive response to language generating meaning and music. That is true, whether the spark igniting the poem comes from a word, a phrase, an image, a moment, in experience, present or remembered. This spark is what Osip Mandelstam, the great Russian poet of the 20th century, called poriv, or impulse, and what Emerson thinks of as what is oldest and best in us, the alien visitor. This not knowing is a hovering and receptive state of consciousness without intention or conscious knowledge of its direction. We play with it and revise it after the fact, bearing down on the poem with our always incommensurate knowledge of the resources of our art. But I also know that consciousness can be incised by experience, seared by memory, awakened by what is seen and lived, and that the poet's language also passes through this fire and is marked by it. The surrender of conscious control so necessary to the receptive artistic state does not mean that the mark of experience will not be burned into the poem and be made legible there. When we read for this mark, we read for witness. And at times, along with aesthetic pleasure and the frisson of newly made meanings, we are also not perhaps persuaded, but certainly transported to regions of experience that might inform our conscience so as to make art in the light of it, as Marina Tsvetaeva wrote. James Baldwin wrote, "It is not a question of memory. Oedipus did not remember the thongs that bound his feet. Nevertheless, the marks they left testified to that doom toward which his feet were leading him. The man does not remember the hand that struck him, the darkness that frightened him. As a child, nevertheless, the hand and the darkness remain with him, indivisible from himself forever, part of the passion that drives him wherever he thinks to take flight." Poets regard their artistic mission variously. Antonio Machado desired to create a metaphysics to underlie his work. Boris Pasternak insisted on gazing more purely than others do. Luis Cernuda believed that in isolation, the poet experiences more deeply the beauty of the surrounding world. Seamus Heaney believed one must write for the joy of it and be true to one's disposition. W.S. Merwin appeals to freedom and to speaking for any kind of life that cannot speak for itself. I think of literary writing as a means of retrieving a human knowledge irretrievable by other means. Composing poems and writing stories is a meditative, spiritual act of resistance. It requires a capacity to sustain contemplation, to be attentive to all that is about us, and to hold within ourselves an awareness that we are here in our living moment between two unknown realms, before our birth and after our deaths. We speak through art to the millennia of artists who came before us, and the art we make will send its message to the human future. Curiosity about our predecessors and care for our descendants is a collective accomplishment. Art is what we have left behind, and art is what we will leave to the world to come. We gaze at the same moon as did the cave painters of Chauvet, even though there are now boot prints upon that moon. The wine-dark seas of Homer are still our seas, even if parts of their waters are now dead zones. If we retain our capacity for meditative awareness, the languages of art that allow us to speak through time will not be lost. The slow, solitary engagement with music and word, paint and light, with our bodies in space and time, that is the precondition of making art, might not only preserve our capacities as artists, but as humans possessed of intuitive intelligence and inner life. Poets and artists are conversant with centuries of their kind, and their visions may address the most pressing need of the epoch, that of saving the biosphere of Earth, thus preserving her flora and fauna, as well as our own kind with our probative and dangerous intelligence, our inventiveness, our glorious consciousness shimmering between the two darknesses, that shimmering that we regard as time. Poetry is the deep musical articulation of this awareness. And whatever may be said of our precarious literary art, poetry needs no justification, but must only endure. And that is in the hands of its practitioners in this moment. So that is what I think about poetry. You thought I was going to talk about countries. Well, I was very lucky in my life as a poet, and very lucky in my education and my mentorship on this campus. I wrote a lot of my first book in Snyder Phillips. I heard my first living poets' voices played on reel-to-reel tapes in the now torn down Morrill Hall. See, they're just tearing down and ending everything for me. So so it means something to me that I can trace a lot of what happened to me in the past. My Spanish teacher at this university was from El Salvador, and he showed me beautiful slides of his lovely house and the gardens and so on. So when I first went to El Salvador, I thought I was going to see places like his house. You know, he was from a wonderful family in El Salvador. And he showed me an El Salvador that does exist. But I mean, I can connect so many things that happened here to what happened next. The reason for everything was that as a young teacher of freshman composition in San Diego, California, in the mid-1970s, I was at a friend's house and it started to rain torrentially. And I didn't want to get wet because I was going out later. And so I stayed longer than I would have and read the poetry of a woman whom I would then come to translate. And that woman's nephew would visit me in San Diego, California, from El Salvador in the fall of 1977. And he would invite me to spend my Guggenheim fellowship year in El Salvador. And he told me the war was coming, but of course I told him that we had just gotten out of Vietnam and so there was nothing to worry about. There wasn't going to be any more wars because we learned our lesson and we were tired of it. He said, "Really? Are you sure?" But I was sure, and he just smiled, and he said, come to El Salvador. Did you understand Vietnam from the beginning? Did you understand it when you were marching on Grand River Avenue? And I said, I was opposed to the war, but I couldn't say I understood it. He said, would you like to see one from the beginning?
Oh, wow.
So I thought, well, yes. I could understand, finally. But I really thought I was going there to improve my Spanish, translate other poets, and so on, and also invent my own Peace Corps experience, because I had never joined the Peace Corps. This led to working until March 16, 1980. It was a very difficult and dangerous time, but it was the time that precedes war, the time when it's possible to stop it, the time when people tried to stop it and failed. And I was able to watch that process and then immerse myself in it and then lose track of myself and think that I should stay beyond when I should have stayed. And the Archbishop of San Salvador, Monsignor Oscar Romero, strongly urged me to get out of the country. We had dinner together on March 15th. 16th, I was out of the country, and 24th, he was assassinated while saying mass at a chapel. It wasn't in the cathedral, it was in a chapel of Divine Providence Hospital. And I came back to the United States. What he wanted me to do was talk to the American people. He didn't understand that poets don't have opportunities to talk to the American people, that the American people do not regard poets, I wouldn't say not highly, but I would say they don't take us seriously on the issues of foreign policy and so on. So I told him that I probably wouldn't be able to do it and I would fail to do it. And he said, no, you're going to do it. You have to get ready. You have to be prepared. The book, The Country Between Us, was published almost 2 years later it was published, after I came back, and just at the time that El Salvador was in the headlines in the papers. And so suddenly, this poetry book was used by newspaper columnists and was all of a sudden, okay, we have these poems about El Salvador and these things are happening in El Salvador, and I found myself invited to all over the country, to colleges and universities. Normally, second books of poems stay in the garage in a box, and the friends and the family buy and read it. But it's kind of a quiet experience, the publication of one second book, generally. This wasn't for me. And it began something. I, very soon after that, married a man I had met in a refugee camp in El Salvador. He was working for Time magazine at the time, and we went off to Beirut, Lebanon. There's a story behind that, but I wound up getting a press credential and working for All Things Considered in Beirut. So I felt like that I was in a kind of graduate school, a kind of horrific graduate school that started in El Salvador, went through Lebanon, and then more or less came to a conclusion in South Africa, March 17th. 1986. I know the date because my son was born a month later in France, the country to which we were more or less invited to reside precipitously by this South African security state. So for me, I felt very fortunate because as a poet, I don't think you can be awake enough to the world of your time. I'm not saying that what you are awake to has to be war or harsh circumstances or experiences of extremity. But wakefulness is demanded, I think, of serious literary art on some level or another. And so I reject the view that there's subject matter that doesn't belong in literary art. I reject the view that there's something called politics that has no place in the thing called poetry in my country. So, but the issue of the poet and the state and the relation between poetry and politics and this civil responsibility that we all have, including the poets, is another matter. When the book became controversial, the other thing we do is we have panel discussions in response to serious issues that arise. And usually every university has a panel discussion on the same subject in any given year. And that year, it was poetry and politics. So I did a lot of panels. And I discovered that there were two sides. There's two sides to everything in the United States. There's actually about 20,000 sides, but there are two sides that they boil things down to. And the one side said, poetry and politics have nothing to do with each other. All political poets fail. All political poetry fails. It's programmatic, it's propagandistic, et cetera. And then there's the other side, that any poem that's about something that people regard as political is strong and important by virtue of that fact. So this led to the collection Against Forgetting, in which I studied 20th century poets who actually went through things and wondered what they wrote in the aftermath. And I found out that most poets in the 20th century, especially outside the English-speaking world, had lived through wars, imprisonment, forced exile, house arrest, and so on. So they were collected together, beginning with the Armenian genocide and ending at Tiananmen Square, because that was the last event before the manuscript was due at the publishers. And I actually thought that because the Soviet Union had broken apart and we were supposed to remember an era of peace ushering into the world, because the Cold War posited that the Soviet Union had been the problem, I failed to include a number of other wars that occurred in the rest of the 20th century. It begins with a motto by Bertolt Brecht: in the dark times, will there also be singing? Yes, there will be singing about the dark times. And after proceeding through the Russian Revolution, First World War, Second World War, Spanish Civil War, and so on, all these sections, it ends with another motto by Brecht: this then is all. It's not enough, I know. At least I'm still alive, as you can see. I'm like the man who took a brick to show how beautiful his house used once to be. By the way, on the subject of bricks, I have been told that Morrill Hall bricks are for sale. If anyone is willing to sell one or knows about one, I would like a Morrill Hall brick in my writing office, okay? This is what I really want, because my first poetic voices were heard in that hall. And if I have a brick, maybe I won't stop hearing them, you know? And so I would like to invite your questions. And please, you can ask about anything at all. The various countries, the poetry, the issues, whatever I can answer, I will. And if I can't, I promise I won't. I won't make something up. Okay, yes.
When you judge poetry, as you did in the contest,
yes,
what criteria do you use to judge that poetry? And how do your own standards of poetry rest with what is on that manuscript and the poet's standards of good poetry?
Well, it's very difficult because it's, of course, completely subjective, as are all faculty when they grade, right? That's what students think. But I watched for a certain command of poetic resources, a certain passion driving the poem. I mean, I wanted music, compression. I wanted to see the poet that I chose was making several things happen at once in his poems. And the imagery was quite vivid and precise, but there was also a beautifully cadenced rhythm to the lines. And he didn't end the poem patly. He allowed a kind of resolution that was richly ambiguous. So one is sent back through the poem in all kinds of ways. And here's a funny thing about this young man. I could say there were a lot of great entries in that contest, and I like them very much. The three I had the hardest time deciding among were all three written, as it turns out, by him. But they weren't
at all alike. You wouldn't necessarily have imagined them all to have come from the same person. I was rather surprised to find that out because they were so various. So I realized that I was holding in my hands the work of somebody who had really taken this seriously and really worked for a while and had read quite a lot of poetry. That was obvious too. That said, you know, poetry contests are very subjective. They depend not only on the sensibility of the judge, the biases and proclivities of the judge, but also on the mood of the judge that day, you know, and whether they have a headache or not. I tell people, don't think of the Yale Prize means that one judge on one day in one particular year was having a nice morning when he opened your manuscript and you wound up on the finalist pile. You know, and then after you're on the finalist pile, anything can happen. Anyone can win. You know, you're almost tempted. You're so stymied sometimes with, I had 15 poems I was trying to decide among. You know, you could almost think, okay, I'm going to throw them up in the air and the one that lands closest to me is the winner. But you can't do that, of course, because you're making a judgment. And the air and the carpet are not a judgment. But it's, you know, so it's not something, it's something that allows us to honor a particular poet at a particular time. But it doesn't mean something set in stone about that poet or any of the other poets who enter. I'm doing a lot of judging right now, and I've realized that I worry about the ones I don't pick. So I don't know how much longer I can judge things. I think if I was a judge in real life, everybody would get off, you know, because I would sympathize on some level or another with these human beings. So you see, I can't. That's what I tell to get out of jury duty. It works really well. I say, I really think most people are innocent most of the time. They make mistakes, you know, but they're basically good. Anne Frank said that, yes. Okay, what else? I promise not to be, I won't make other jokes. You see, I'm not all Sturm und Drang, you know, I'm not, yes.
Your comment about the appropriateness of a subject like political or poetry. Another one that I find interesting is the label of something as class warfare.
Right.
I don't know what the opposite of that is. It's the other side. We don't have class warfare because other people.
Well, what I noticed about people who get accused of being political here are almost always oppositional, you know.
Yeah. And political.
Right.
And I'm sorry.
And class warfare is usually the term applied to any attempt of the poor, the working poor, the unemployed, the disenfranchised, to better their lives. That's my definition of what they mean by class warfare. It's usually deployed by the privileged, economically privileged. I've never really heard it deployed by anyone else. So, you know, you have to take these terms with a grain of salt. The problem is that they poison and contaminate our political discourse in this country. And so it becomes a false language that we all have to learn and speak. You know, I agree with you. And that's what political poetry is, too, that term. That just means your poem is making me uncomfortable. That's what it means. What else, Ewan?
Well, yes? Obviously, you found enough people who had written poems that could be defined as political, but there's...
Well,
there.
I would say I found a lot of poems written by people who had gone through things, and those things were apparent in the work that followed in some way, even a subtle way. I mean, I don't know how political writing about the ice on the water jug melting in the Turkish prison, you know, is really. It's ice, it's a water jug, it's spring, you know, that means that if the ice can freeze on the water jug in the cell, by extension, the misery endured by the person incarcerated there, you see. So I'm not sure what people mean by the word political. we could talk about imagery, and we could talk about, well, let's see, we could talk about the Gordon riots, those actual fires. They were actual fires in London. Blake walked through them. We like to think he's making up some kind of cosmology that has to do with fires, but I just learned that a lot of English language poetry in the tradition, that's the second volume, is Poetry of Witness, the Tradition in English, 1500 to 2001, is published in 2014. And really, if you read, the thing I like about this particular volume, it's not so much the poetry, because you'll know a lot of the poems, not all, there's some discoveries there, but the biographies are not the biographies you usually read about the English poets, English language poets. And what's really fun for me is to read all the biographies, all as one text threading through the work. And you will find that most English language poets from 1500 to the present suffered through wars, were imprisoned, were tortured, were executed, threatened with execution, incarcerated on slave ships. There were people who were incarcerated to work the slave ships, as well as people incarcerated as slaves, and so on and so forth. It's endless. But most of the poets that you find in the other anthologies of the English tradition are in our anthology. So that what that tells me is that this notion of the poet as being removed from his or her society and his or her time is a rather odd construction and doesn't correspond to anything in reality. It's very interesting. Even Emily Dickinson, the person we like to think of in the white dress up in her room, well, apparently it's becoming clear that she took a train to Washington, D.C. in the middle of the Civil War. She wrote three poems explicitly about her concern for the soldiers who were suffering and dying. She was vividly aware of her time and informed by it. Who knows what she saw on that very slow train journey down to what amounted to the border of the South and the North. So even she doesn't escape. She doesn't get to stay in the room, in the little oak chair, in the dress, in our anthology anyway. So I just feel that this notion that we can somehow live apart and just write out of our apart ignorance doesn't seem to be a bear up. It doesn't bear up. You know, and our tradition is something very different than what we think, than what we imagine it as. I'm not saying every poet, but so many you would be surprised.
Maybe the criticism of political poetry is sort of like foot binding of women. It's a way of neutralizing poets so that
some of it happened in the 30s and in the aftermath of the 30s when there was a very strong socialist movement in the U.S. And, of course, the New Deal was a response to that. There are books written about the literature of the 30s, the poets and writers writing in that vein in the 30s. I think that the agrarian poets developed a method of close reading, which is very useful. And that new criticism, which is also very useful, excludes consideration of anything that is extra textual or off the page. So you can't think about the poet's life. You can't imagine what those images might be coming from or referring to. The poem is an organic whole that is analyzed completely intratextually. It is an organic work that is almost mechanically analyzed for the relationships among its parts. So I believe that there's something beautiful to be said for close reading, but I also think that it's a way of removing literature from its context in the world. That was a corrective to earlier faults of earlier criticism, but nevertheless, it was very effective politically. It's not a coincidence that the agrarians were mostly quite conservative men. Yes?
That we can't understand language without context. That context is a much bigger part of the meaning of language than the actual words themselves or the grammar.
Right. That's right. Yeah. So I don't understand how this notion of apartness, of poets removed from the world, how it became so entrenched and why. But I think it's over. I see poets writing much more freely and much more in a much more engaged way now. And they're not getting the kinds of attacks that poets used to get. It's just not happening. I'm not sure exactly why. I think that I don't want to attribute too much to a particular event in American history, but in my lifetime, I saw a shift in the country after this country was attacked on its own soil. And I think it was shocking to the country, and I think it was a little bit, this shift was seismic. And what I mean is that there were aftershocks and ripples for quite a few years and into our present moment. And it started to sound absurd. For one thing, that attack occurred in New York City, which likes to think of itself as the center of the literary universe. So the center of the literary universe was traumatized very deeply. And this changed Americans' ideas about this, I think. It wasn't distant anymore. It was imaginable, and for them, you see, I mean, for us. So I think that had there's an element of that. I don't want to attribute everything to that. We could also say there's a vast demographic shift in this country, and that underneath the surface of what we hear articulated as our political discourse, there are magnificent changes happening. I think those are the plate tectonics of our political reality. And on the surface, we see this cracking discourse of, I don't want to describe it because I want to stay in a good mood, but but I think there are other things happening besides that we have to be, you know, we have to be, what are those instruments called? Seismograph. We have to be little seismographs, and we have to pay attention to the fact that what we see on the surface is not all that is happening. You know, for one thing, Claudia Rankine wrote Citizen. Citizen was on the New York Times bestseller list. Claudia Rankine is a best-selling writer. She's being taught all over the world, not just in the United States. I mean, and she's not being taken to task for her subject matter. For me, that's revolutionary and amazing. So I'm very happy about that. If you haven't read Citizen, you should read it. What else did you like? Yes?
In your interview with Mark Reichard today, you talked about that poetry occupies the space between the privacy of the soul.
Yeah.
And institutions such as the nation state. And I'd never heard that description of poetry in exactly the same way. What I have heard in life, though, from Freud, is that when he was asked what should human beings be able to do well, he said to love well and to work well. I'm interested in your answer to the question about what are the kinds of tensions that you feel inside that space having to do with love, work, suffering, and the like. Because that's not, I don't think that that's an easy place to be. And I think it's often filled with tension.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't.
So is the intimacy of the domestic sphere.
You bet. You bet.
And so definitely are the institutions of our governance. So there really is no easy space. And all of it is difficult, right?
Yes.
But in terms of that social space that we were talking about, actually the founders of this country envisioned it to be much larger than it has grown to be. In other words, our debate, publishing, production, artistic production, all of that occurs in a social space. Unless you're writing for the desk drawer forever, to publish means to be public. So all it means, the social space, is our interrelation with each other, what we are communally, collectively, what we are to our fellow human beings. And we write out of an inwardness, but that inwardness is posited on a communicability, and that communicability is the light between, the interstitial light between us, how we're able to commend our inner worlds to each other. And of course, what we share those. So I don't see any of these spheres as particularly easy. And really, this is a metaphor, of course. It's a construction. These aren't really that separate in a way. But I wanted to think about another way to talk about this thing that Americans call politics or the political, because I don't think we all mean the same thing by it. And I think there's something that's very important to drill down to in that term. And the gentleman there who talked about, when we were talking about how it's used pejoratively, people are attacked for being political because actually they're just oppositional. And political poems are attacked because they make us uncomfortable. You know, what we mean by political, this is kind of a dismissive term we use, you know. Political poem, political person, oh, that's all political. You know, well, all of that means something different depending on the context. You know, there's office politics. We all know about that, right? We can sort of grasp that. But in general terms, to call a writer political doesn't seem useful to me. If a writer does not have an element of concern for the polis, if the writer does not have any political awareness, I can't imagine he or she being all that interesting, you know? It's because that's part of life. The best art, the most serious art, comes from awareness, and not an awareness of everything. And I think one thing that we have to fight against in our literary tradition, but also in our culture, is our concern for the self and our focus upon the self and our sense of individuation. We believe that we have a culture of individualism, which is also a false construct, because all of us got here through the agency of other people, first of all. We were born through the agency of other people. You know, we survive to adulthood through the agency of other people. We're completely interdependent and interconnected, and of course, that's a little scary, but that's what it is. And I think we have too much focus in a lot of our literature on personal experience. And I think commercial confessionalism has not done us any favors in our literature as well, or in our lives. You know, this sort of self-disclosure, endless self-disclosure, televised therapeutic talk or something, commodification of self, allowing one's personal, deep personal life and the challenges of that life to become fodder for entertainment, it seems to me to be damaging to us. And one of the things that I'm interested in, why I read serious literature, is against that. You know, so I am reading. I guess one of my biases is the writer looking out or only looking in? Is the writer locked in his or her own personal experience? Or does the writer connected beyond the self to the outside. I suppose that without that dimension, you know, unless the language is crazy interesting, and, you know, then I think I lose interest now, because we are immersed and surrounded by that commodification of the self, making deeply precious, important human experience fungible. Yeah.
I wonder, in your experience with violence in different parts of the world, and as you've observed all of that, what your thoughts might be about reconciliation in any nuance or any sense of promise?
Well, there's a lot of thinking about truth commissions, reconciliation, truth and reconciliation, memorialization. I have a lot of things to say on those subjects. What I will say is reconciliation done prematurely closes off the possibility of a long-term healing process and probably forces eventually the violence to be repeated. So reconciliation is an important goal, but the process shouldn't be imposed on people who haven't yet come to terms with what has happened to them. And for example, I'll just give the example. It was only days after the Truth Commission released its report in El Salvador that a general amnesty was declared against all perpetrators of violence during the 12-year civil war. So the killers are all walking around, you know, the killers have their houses and they're all, and some of them are here in our country. So it just was too early for that. And I'm not saying I don't advocate, you know, a terrible witch hunt and go after everyone who did everything, but there has to be an examination of the past, and there can't just be a preemptive declaration of amnesty. There are aspects of Truth and Reconciliation Commission thinking and experience that have been, in the long run, thought to be unwise. We've learned something from each Truth Commission, and they've been variously conducted and have had varying effects. So it's important. The other thing is, if you think about it in terms of memorialization, you build a monument in honor of, say, a people who suffered genocide. Okay, now we have the monument. We've done this. It's all set. Let's go. Let's move on. There's something I want to say about moving on. There's no such thing as closure. There's no such thing as getting over it. We live in the aftermath of what happened. It can never be undone. We can learn to live in it graciously, gracefully, generously, in lots of ways, but you can't undo what happens. You can't unsay what's said. So the idea that a monument is going to take care of the business, if it hasn't been taken care of in other ways, is false. It's a piece of stone. Pigeons are going to do their business on it, you know? People are going to visit and throw a rose on the ground. It's not going to undo what happened. So there is a lot of thinking now about remembering and forgetting, and what should be remembered and what forgotten, and precisely when and by whom. And it sounds, why are we belaboring this? It sounds well, obvious, but it isn't. You know, there are ways to reach our beautiful goals of reconciliation and the achievement of peace, which is not just the absence of violence. And violence is not just what happens between human beings in warfares or brawls or fights. There's also institutionalized violence of systematic deprivation of people, of their access to their full humanity. So if we have institutionalized a violence, that violence will emerge in other ways. I don't know. I don't have time to develop this, but I came awake to institutional violence in El Salvador because everyone was paying attention to the bodies in the streets. That's violence. And, you know, people killing each other, that was violence. And the torture in the prisons, that was violence. But there was a much bigger violence that was more difficult to see, more pervasive, and it governed all the other violence. And all the other violence emerged from it. And that was the way that the social and economic structure had been set up. It was impossible to escape the violence, and sometimes other than by means of violence. So, yeah, it's complicated. Well, it's different. I was quite surprised by the difference in South Africa. I went finally back after more than 30 years. And they were very self-critical. We have this problem and that problem and this problem. We haven't achieved this and we haven't achieved that. But I was like Rip Van Winkle. You know, it was like an armed camp. I can't begin to describe what it was like. I left the airport with a bunch of soldiers and guns, and, you know, I came back to an airport that was bustling and had a lot of shops and smiling people, and people of all races were stamping people into the country. And one woman, the one I had, said, "How long has it been since you've been in South Africa?" And I said, 32 years. And she said, "Oh, welcome to South Africa." You know, and I looked around and I was like, this isn't the country that I left. It isn't the country that I left. They ended the apartheid regime. That should not be forgotten. Whatever else now emerges, they ended the apartheid regime. That was enormous. So, and through the efforts of many people over many decades.
I think maybe we'll stop now, if that's okay with folks, because
it's 4:00. I really enjoyed talking to you. I hope you got something in. I hope your questions were addressed, even if, you know. But thank you for coming. Thank you.